Hi folks, this is Christian with another edition of Ice Age Farmer Podcast. As always, mapping a path forward to prosperity, building resilient, self-sufficient communities, and sharing knowledge in the grand solar minimum. Today is Sunday, August 6th, and this is episode 7 of the Ice Age Farmer Podcast. Pretty excited about the show today. It's the full moon show, and we'll be starting, as always, with the daily steps that folks in our community, including myself, are taking to prepare their families for food security in the times ahead and in general. And then we'll dip into an icebreaker section, the history. This time I'm going to be reading a piece by Dr. Sam Khoury, which is great. It's sort of analyzing the decline of the Roman Empire and asking whether there were actually climatic influences. Actually, it's suggesting quite firmly that there were, and that those same things are echoing now, as we know. And we are seeing, similarly, the decline of the modern Anglo-American Empire, the West, what have you. So I think you'll enjoy hearing that piece. Some good information in there. We'll then take a look at the news and see how the data about the Grand Solar Minimum is actually sort of pouring out every day through headlines. There's too much stuff going on, and I'm actually pretty pleased with the way that my Twitter account is working as just a constant stream of the headlines that are related to the Grand Solar Minimum. And so I'm going to keep to the rule here in this show that the news section is strictly data that helps us build the future. So in any information that that's relevant to our plans and how we'll be building food production systems going forward is what I'll be highlighting here. But always on twitter.com/iceagefarmer is sort of the fire hose of stuff. So feel free to look me up there as well if you want the full version of the news. And then we'll be getting back to questions. So first I'm going to share with you a response to a question from episode 6, which was speaking to how to establish a new home site as a self-sufficient property. This person makes the case for using a dairy cow. And we'll hear his experiences and his reasons for making that case. And then I might qualify with some of my own thoughts there. And then I'll also take a question from Zach, who asks, how possibly can I share information about the Grand Solar Minimum or even get about my own personal preparations without appearing completely insane to the people around me? And so we'll speak to that. But before we do all that, I'd like to remind you that Ice Age Farmer is available on iTunes, iceagefarmer.com/iTunes, as well as on Stitcher, iceagefarmer.com/Stitcher. We continue to post the podcasts and videos to our YouTube channel, iceagefarmer.com/YouTube. So feel free to use whatever mechanism is most convenient for you to subscribe to the show and to share those links in whatever format your friends or family need to get them. There, we're making this available in as many different ways as we can so that it can be reaching as many different people as possible. All right, with that, let's get on to the Daily Steps segment, where folks from the Ice Age Farmer community share their experiences and their lessons, their progress in general towards food security. A few folks I've heard from have been starting moringas, which is fun to see. I did hear from Great Laker, who has successfully merged 5 young pullets into a coop of older hens, which is harder than it sounds to get them to all get along. I also sewed a bunch of gauze, tulle, bags, and put them over my heirloom pepper plants to keep them from cross-pollinating. I did some cleaning in my greenhouse of the stuff left behind from growing seedlings earlier, and then I read about raising rabbits, which might be a project for next year. A fun one, I would add. All right, we also heard from Rocker78, who put terraced shelves along the afternoon sun side brick wall with 5 shelves and grew different veggies on each shelf. He's trying something new. You would be surprised, he adds, how much food one needs to grow to support a family. I would recommend growing 60% of whatever grows well for you that you can trade others who garden. And on my front, I am up to my neck in blackberries right now. I'm scratched, bleeding all over. My hands are dyed purple. I need to go get some more because they went pretty quickly on my son's pancakes this morning. But I love blackberries. I'm probably going to freeze some and might try some canning, or I don't know. I guess the way to do that is a blackberry syrup. So maybe that's worth trying. But then again, that isn't exactly the best low-carb way to move forward. So we'll see what happens with those blackberries. Also been, I finally put a ton of starts in the aquaponics system, and I'm defending them ruthlessly against whatever invader has been eating them in the last few months, which is why the beds are a little sparse right now. If it's the slug, then honestly, I don't really know how to secure my grow beds from slugs. I had plans for some other, depending on what it actually turns out to be. Anyway, I'll let that security camera time lapse keep running because it's fun to watch the plants at night anyway. And we'll see how those starts do. Hopefully they don't get eaten up like the rest. With the moringas, I started having some spots and even leaf rot on the two biggest, the oldest moringas, the ones that I've actually been eating from, harvesting from. And it may be that they had started to be watered from above, which can result in a mold forming on the leaves and then getting transferred to the rest. That's one possibility. I also went ahead and repotted them because I was worried that they had outgrown their little 5-gallon containers. At this point, I put them both in one huge pot, and now I'm wondering if that was a mistake. I know their root systems will get commingled real quick, so let me know. Have you had success with two trees in the same pot, especially if you're going to be continuously harvesting and trimming them down to size? Or is that just a bad idea and they'd be better off in their own containers? Let me know what you think. I've seen arguments both ways. Maybe you've got experiences. Maybe it depends on the tree. I don't know. We'll find out. And then one quick note. The 2-inch NFT system that I built had completely clogged up with the root ball of a kale plant yesterday. So I'm going to go ahead and issue an Ice Age Farmer advisory on using 2-inch PVC pipe for the NFT. It basically, I would not do it. If I were going to do it again, I would buy the 3-inch PVC and its fittings. It's a bit more pricey, but you wouldn't have to, I wouldn't now be in a position where I have to constantly monitor the root balls of every plant that's in my little hydroponic system just to make sure that they're not going to clog up sometime during the day today. They will be the ones that clog up and cause the hydroponic solution to pour over the edges of the pipe. So if I were to do it again, I would use 3 inches like the NFT pipe that I have on the aquaponic system, which has never clogged up and continues to produce until this day. So I would follow that example. But since I've already built this thing using 2-inch PVC, I think I'm going to have to just use things with less dense root balls, like herbs, onions, I don't know, keep it pretty just sort of mid-sized leafy greens, smaller things. We'll see if I can just keep it flowing without getting backed up. That'd be fantastic. I don't want to have to trash the thing. It's been working after all. In fact, it's been running for a month now successfully, and so that's something to celebrate. What about you? What are you doing today to make sure that tomorrow you are more secure in your food supply and your nutrition for your family and in general for your sovereignty for moving forward into the grand solar minimum, the changing climate, the extremes, the crazy weather? We'll hear more about in the news section here in a bit. But let me know. Send me a note, icehfarmer@gmail.com or add a comment below and let me know what's going on. What lessons have you learned? What experiences have you had lately? What progress are you making? It's great to share that information and keep our progress moving forward. All right, now let's take a look at the icebreaker section. Some more history on the way that extreme climate changes throughout history have played out and how we can learn from that data. Today, as I mentioned, I wanted to read from Dr. Sam Corey's opinion piece recently. He's had a few of these. This guy is actually a doctor, a dentist here in California. But I just wanted to share this piece with you. I'll go ahead and read. Solar minimums, which I always call solar minima. I actually think minimums, it bothers me, but let's not get picky here. Solar minima may be the final piece of the puzzle in the fall of Western civilization. Not one to play down the title there. This is from the July 29th Nation. Academics often compare Western civilization to the Roman Empire. This is hardly surprising when you consider that Amsterdam, London, and Washington all compared themselves to Rome while constructing Romanesque government buildings and laws. The period 500 to 100 BC saw the ascension of that empire. The general population was overwhelmingly poor, yet their loyalty and respect for the Roman Republic was high. Women were burdened with the job of creating and nurturing many children so they could go off to some far off place to be butchered for the Republic. These men trusted the civilian government that sent them to fight the Punic Wars against Carthage, whose fearsome commander, Hannibal, threatened Rome's very survival. The men who fought these tough battles were citizen soldiers, like the draftees used by the United States or other Western countries until the early 70s. Our own Punic Wars, the two world wars, and the conflicts in Korea and Vietnam saw millions of poor and working class citizen soldiers sacrifice themselves fighting a powerful enemy they believed threatened their very way of life. So making some connections already. By the first century BC, Rome was the most advanced and powerful civilization on earth, and Romans' material wealth was skyrocketing. Men and women are increasingly less interested in marriage, and no-fault divorce is enacted. Birth rates start to decline below the replacement rate. The citizen soldiers are eventually replaced with professional soldiers who expect compensation and are loyal to the military itself, not to the state. As the empire expands in a series of wars of choice, it becomes increasingly multicultural thanks to new citizens from these conquered territories. Their loyalty is in question, but Rome depends on them as mercenaries to defend the declining state. The government and the military-industrial complex replace the private sector as the sole entity responsible for everyone's well-being. There is moral decay and brutality as Julius Caesar brags about killing 1 million Gauls. Just like Hillary Clinton, we came, we saw, he died, right? Moral decay. This period could be compared to our own world since 1970. By the 400s, Rome is being pillaged by Visigoths and Vandals who ensure it never makes it to the 500s. However, there is something else occurring in the 400s that wasn't happening in the preceding centuries. Although corruption and immorality were rife, the scientific and historical record shows the climate cooled, but even more destructively, it became erratic. Long, dry conditions were interrupted by intense deluges. Unseasonal spells of cold weather became the norm. Although solar activity records only date back to the 1600s, these conditions were almost certainly the result of a combination of low solar activity and high volcanic activity. Much like the post-medieval warm period that saw solar minima like the so-called Maunder and Dalton, and large volcanic eruptions like the Tambora, which, combined with the Dalton, created literally freezing summers. The result during the 400s for the Roman Empire was rising food prices, which along with the other factors, like we know they debased their currency, created deep social dissatisfaction as the economy faltered. In today's world, Western countries have recklessly created wars in Muslim lands only to accept millions of refugees. The argument has been made that these immigrants are necessary due to the falling birth rates of indigenous populations, which leads to faltering economic growth. On the other hand, developed countries like Japan, South Korea, Taiwan also have low birth rates, but they don't create wars in the Middle East and don't accept massive influxes of refugees. The two issues seem to go hand in hand, like a new Rome invading territories, raising their civilizations to the ground and acquiring both their skilled and unskilled workers. In both the U.S. and Western Europe, the tension is building between recent immigrants and the indigenous population, punctuated by lone wolf random attacks, quote-unquote. The population is in the U.S. increasingly suspicious of the government as it raises the debt ceiling again and again to pay for entitlements, the military-industrial complex, and other government-subsidized programs that create employment. It has spent trillions in Middle Eastern wars, which are now being fought by Kurdish Arab mercenaries who expect $1,000 a month. Skipping a little bit. Enter the monkey wrench. After 200 years of healthy solar maxima, solar activity has been plummeting since 2010, and the first solar minimum will hit bottom around 2021. By the 2030s, solar physicists now reckon, this is published research, that a grand solar minimum will consume most of the rest of the century. Volcanic activity has also been on the increase, and more is expected as eruptions occur most often during solar cycle peaks or as now at the solar minimum. In previous articles published, I chronicled increasingly intense and erratic weather patterns that have coincided with this lower solar activity. The latest include a cold front that descended on the U.S. Midwest in late June, dropping temperatures to near freezing, and a recent snowfall in Moscow. Plus, as we'll see in the news sections today, it's snowing in Colorado in August. Wheat futures immediately rose 6% after that June snow. At the time, the world takes cheap foodstuffs for granted. A change in that reality would shake the global world order to its foundations. And I'm going to include a link to this below because I feel like it's well-written and a nice summary that offers both the historical parallel as well as the modern data to indicate that we're entering the same sort of a period, all in one pretty skillfully wrapped package here. So props to Dr. Sam Corey. Well done. I might reach out to him, but I'm definitely sharing with you this piece so that you can share it with whomever you feel is ready to receive it. We do need to spread the word, and we'll talk about that in the final section of the day, the questions, the importance of spreading the word about what's going on right now, and how to do so without appearing crazy. With that, let's move on to the news. All right, so as I already mentioned, these are headlines specifically related to informing us and the way we will be preparing to deal with the changing climate and social conditions in the future here. So first, just a quick mention that indeed we are still seeing snow in the middle of August in Colorado. Obviously, this is out of the ordinary. There are many other signs indicating that the summer has been wet and cool. Here on AgWeb, which is great agricultural news, we see that there have been advisories issued for stink bug pest infestations, which is really interesting. Only because I only bring it up here, as I mentioned, and I've done this before, to point out that there are effects from the climate changes that we can't even imagine, right? Before, I think it was that there was a ton of crickets and they were causing cricket slicks on the road. People were crashing. And this time it's that the planting, as we see here, the planting dates were late in many areas and the cool weather has slowed plant growth, which means that maturity is delayed in many areas. These late maturing crops are remaining vulnerable to pest injury longer than usual. So the conditions have created, the weather conditions have created conditions in the crops that mean that they are more vulnerable to pests. These are the kind of secondary effects that I am saying repeatedly. We have no idea how complicated the system is and how many aspects of food production this will touch and affect going forward. Let's move on. There was a freeze in Australia recently that was so extreme that it devastated hot water panels, heaters, as well as tons of pipes. So plumbers have been struggling to keep up with demand. And I bring this up to illuminate that the rapidly changing weather conditions and extremes and out of season, especially the out of season weather extremes, are going to wreak havoc on our infrastructure. We have very bespoke infrastructures that are built to withstand a narrow range of tolerances. And as our climate departs that tolerant range, our systems are going to fail. And so as you design your own systems to ensure your own security, make sure that you harden these systems against all sorts of conditions. Now, we've all heard about this Lucifer heat wave because the coverage is insane. In fact, some people are questioning whether or not it's an engineered heat wave, a deliberately delivered pocket of heat over Europe, both because it furthers the agenda and because the how extreme it is, right? Up to 50 degrees Celsius, which is 122 degrees Fahrenheit, meaning that wildfires are lit. It's just so hot that the forests are just catching on fire. Lots of people are talking about this. You don't see many people talking about the super cold, the out of season snow, of course, because the agenda is to keep you firmly focused on climate change. In fact, so successful have the social engineers and controllers been that Germans, where there are regularly radical attacks and people dying, you know, regularly every so often because of radical terrorism. Well, that doesn't scare me, but climate change, which I would submit has not killed any Germans this year, is in fact much more scary, if you ask them. This just, I bring this up to show the depth of the extremity to which the climate, this is a cult, the climate change cult, which is unfortunately often tied up with the left versus right, liberal versus conservative, but not necessarily. And we've made that distinction here, and I will continue to make it because we don't have time for divide and conquer tactics. This is a matter of who understands what's happening with our solar system, with our star, with our planet as a result of the changes in our sun, and who is indoctrinated by a system that doesn't want us to reach that conclusion. We'll talk more about that in a bit, actually. Another indicator that these people have completely lost their minds, right up there with capturing cow methane, is a study that just came out by a guy who insists that we need to give up our pets because they contribute carbon dioxide. This is Professor Greg Okin, who shouldn't know any longer be holding a position at UCLA, but he does there in Los Angeles. So I think that's really all that I want to mention here, because as much as there is a ton of other information and data, as I mentioned, all of that is on twitter.com/icehfarmer. I don't want to muddy the waters of our podcast, which is focused on building solutions and a path forward, with all the terrible events. There's plenty of channels that are doing that already. So with that, let's go ahead and get to the questions. All right, so there's two parts to the question section today. The first is a listener response to a question from the last episode, wherein we were celebrating an Ice Age Farmer community member who had moved out to a property in East Colorado and was starting the process of making it his own. Today, we get a response from a listener who writes in to make the case for using cows to make that property self-sufficient. We have previously heard that goats are probably going to be a better bet. Actually, let's save that for discussion for after we get to through his letter here. He writes, "It's true that everyone will have a different approach to keeping a self-sufficient homestead, but for me, if I had an acre farm of good, well-drained land, I would absolutely keep a cow, a goat, a few pigs, and some hens. The goat would provide milk when the cow is dry. In fact, I might keep two or more goats. I'd probably have the dairy cow, a Jersey, to provide the pigs and me with milk. More importantly, I would keep her to provide heaps and heaps of lovely cow manure to increase my soil fertility. In order to derive any sort of living from that acre, without the application of a lot of artificial fertilizers, it would have to be heavily manured. On the question of whether or not to keep a cow, there are many advantages and disadvantages, and they work in different ways in different areas for different people. I prefer it because nothing keeps the health of my family and my farm at a higher level than a dairy cow. If you keep your children and have ample, good, fresh, unpasteurized, unadulterated dairy products, you will absolutely be well positioned to be a healthy family. If your pigs and poultry get their share of the milk byproducts, especially whey, they will likely be healthy as well. If your garden gets plenty of cow manure, your soil fertility will continuously increase, along with your yields." So a real force amplifier, he's saying, this cow. "On the other hand, the food that you'll buy in for this family cow, if you don't have enough acreage to collect a ton and a half of hay each season, will cost you hundreds of dollars each year. Compared with how much money you could spend on dairy products, the fresh milk supply from the cow, plus the increased value of the eggs, poultry, and pig meat that you'll get, along with your soil fertility, will quickly make the case a family cow is a worthwhile investment. Then again, you also have to take on the responsibility of milking that cow. It doesn't have to take very long. It's about 8 minutes once you get the hang of it, but you do have to do it. Also, once you buy a cow, it's a pretty big step. You shouldn't do it unless you're not going to go away very much, or unless you have someone with whom you can make arrangements to take over your milking duties while you're gone. This cow, especially in the grand solar minimum, will likely not be able to stay outdoors all year long. She would also horribly overgraze if you only have an acre. She should probably spend most of the winter indoors, if not more than that, only being turned out during the daytime in dry weather to get a little exercise and some fresh air. Cows otherwise don't really benefit from being out in winter weather. Your cow would be, for the most part, better if kept inside, where she would make manure while feeding on the crops you grew for her in the garden. In the summer, you would let her out night and day for as long as you could find the pasture not overgrazed. You'd probably find that your cow did not need hay at all during the summer, but she'd be entirely dependent on the winter, like we said, and you could plan on having to buy her at least a ton, if you want her to rear her yearly calf until she reached some value, then you need another half ton. I have kept my cow on deep litter. The layer of straw gets turned into good manure, and I add clean straw every day. I've milked a cow this way for years, and the perfect milk made good butter and cheese and stored well. Although it's more labor intensive, you could also keep your cow on a concrete floor instead, ideally insulated, and give her a good bed of straw every day. You would remove the soiled straw daily and carefully pile it into a muck heap that would be the fount of fertility for everything on your homestead. Poultry could be kept in a permanent house in one corner of the garden, or preferably in mobile coops on the land so that you can move them over the grassland and improve soil fertility with their scratching and dunging. I would not recommend keeping very many birds, as just a dozen hens should give you enough eggs for a small family, with a few to occasionally sell or give away in summertime. You would have to buy a little grain for them, and in the winter, some protein supplement, unless you can grow enough beans. You could also try growing sunflowers, buckwheat, or other food just for them. Goats, if you keep them instead of a dairy cow, or even in addition to, could be managed in roughly the same way, rotating across the pasture. However, you would not have as much whey and skim milk to rear pigs or poultry on, and you would not build up quite as much the fertility of your land. You'd get only a fraction of the manure from goats as you would from a cow, but on the other hand, you would not have to buy nearly as much hay or straw or trade for it, perhaps not even any. For a farmer wanting to have a completely self-sufficient homestead, even on 1 acre, dairy goats are a pretty good option. All right, I'm going to stop there, but a lot of great information in there and some opinions as well. And I want to back off a bit and sort of retrace our steps. We here within that basic postulate of having a 1 acre property and using a cow to make it self-sufficient, but with the requirement of taking in a ton or a ton and a half of hay every season, some people would say that that's not self-sufficient. Okay, so I know that you can use revenue streams that result from your homestead to make that. You know, you can sell peaches or whatever, trade it to make the money to buy the hay, or raise the cap. You know, there are ways to achieve that without having to go out and get a job to pay for that hay. I'm not suggesting that this doesn't work out at all, but we are looking for a uniquely resilient kind of self-sufficiency here. And so being able to, you know, maybe it is the case that this guy, to make that system work as he describes it, would only need another 4 or 5 acres to get that, to be able to harvest that ton or ton and a half of hay each season, depending on whether or not he wants the calf. Maybe add a couple of extra acres in there just in case production is significantly down due to the reduced sun's output. This is the kind of discussion that I really want to open up here. So I think that we've heard previously from folks who say there's just no way I'd keep a cow going into something like this. I think it's much more prudent to have dairy goats. They produce, in many cases, higher quality milk or higher fat milk, if that is what you're aiming for, is the healthy fats. And so, you know, this is just as he mentioned, actually, as he opened, there are a number of ways to achieve a self-sufficient homestead. And the reason I highlight this, although I don't myself think that I'll just speak for myself, I don't have the skills or knowledge necessary to be able to work a cow on an acre. I just don't see how I could do that. Is that he nonetheless does a great job of showing how the site is a circulating system, like an aquaponics, like whatever you want to think about it as, a closed system where energy flows through different states and you do your best to capture them. Every output should be captured, that energy, so you can channel it back into the site, back into another productive mechanism. So I appreciate that in his message he incorporated that kind of thinking, even if personally I don't. It's not even that I disagree with his conclusions. It's just that I don't think I could pull it off. I just don't. All right. With that, let's get on to the next question, which is a question from Zach. Zach writes, how am I supposed to possibly talk about the grants of the minimum and inform other people, which you ask me to do, when it sounds completely crazy to them? It's like telling them that the sky is black. They just don't believe it. And when I say it, they think that I'm completely insane. Well, that's a great question, Zach. In fact, it's a fantastic question. It's one that it's worth discussing, and I'm glad you raised it so I could. We can only share so much with someone. And this is true in any area. You can only meet someone as deep as they're willing to meet themselves. And that is true as well for trying to share with them the realizations that we've come to here about the history of solar cycles and the fact that we're entering such an extreme time now as a result of those solar cycles, and that there's history and data precedent to look to and learn from if we can just break our away from the mind to think, the brainwashing of the media apparatus. We don't have the power to break someone else out of that trance. Only they can change their belief system. But we can make sure that they hear it from us. We can share just a little bit, and you can only share, as I mentioned, as much as they're willing to hear, and then drop it. Don't push it. It is in the pushing of it and the insisting that they listen to you and acknowledge and agree and accept your beliefs now as their own, that is where you will appear crazy. So if you simply share information, or even just drop the name of the Grand Solar Minimum or Solar Hibernation or something like that, so that the kernel is there and it's primed, and they may go Google it, or they may go ask you about it later, or they may not, and it may not be until the next time that someone else, because you're not going to be forcing this down their throat, but someone else drops the same name or drops a similar concept. And at that point, when someone has heard sort of just casually from three different sources a name or a term or a concept or an idea, then something flips. Right? Something happens inside where they've heard a concept three times from different sources, and it looks like something's going on here. I might need to go check that out. And when that switch happens, then they have opened themselves to critical thought and investigation, and they can modify their belief systems if they can handle it. There are reasons that some people can't. We'll talk about that in a second. But the point to emphasize from what I just said is the importance of us all putting out those little tidbits. If it takes three of us to get a small concept into someone else's mind, then maybe all of us better be just talking about this at random bus stops and in any format. I mean, this is why I started this show, is to make as much noise, making sure that people are hearing these concepts and these ideas. And even if they think I'm crazy, if they hear it on a different channel or from a different person or from a family member or a colleague a few weeks from now, then there's a chance. We build in their mind this path towards the conclusion we eventually need them to reach, which is the truth. But it is only they who can walk it. Now, I'm a very empathetic person, and so I've been thinking a lot about the other side of this. How does it feel to receive this knowledge? Even how does it feel to have it for us right now? There's a huge component of grief associated with the realization that we're entering extreme, interesting, challenging times. Grief's first stage usually is identified pretty directly as denial. And I'm offering this here because I think it's important that we recognize that denial associated with the grief of this realization is absolutely supported by the media, who are also in denial. Actually, they're in full force reverse agenda, keep you from reaching these conclusions, forced global warming down your face. The denial of grief is also supported by the people around you who don't know. So as you reach these conclusions, as one reaches this conclusion and attempts to internalize it, there is always that component of denial associated with the grief. Why are we feeling grief? Well, because there's a future there that we no longer have. There's a future that we had in mind for our children, for the ability to live the kinds of lives with infinite opportunities. I think those expectations are changing. They have to change when you realize what's going on. So of course there's grief, even just for the ability to continue living in the same reality that everyone around you is living. It's a matrix unplugging moment. Once you see what's going on and you realize we must be taking steps towards our own food growing, then the pursuits, the reality television, it's just impossible to plug back into that stuff. if you were ever there. I sort of hope you weren't. There's fear there too, right? It's not just grief. There's fear for the loss of abundance that we are so accustomed to, for the food, the water, the loss of civil society and even the physical security associated with it, for the potential famines and wars. The cryptocracy could potentially use these hungry populations to further enslave us. You know, there's any number of things we can enumerate as fears. Sometimes it's, you know, if you find yourself overwhelmed or anxious as a result, it could be helpful to write them down or enumerate, as I just did for you, a few of them. And you sort of exorcise them, get them down, get them out. And it could also be helpful to do the inverse, right? Do the same thing for what we can celebrate about this new time. Well, there's an absolutely perfectly corrupt economy and political integrated military industrial complex that might collapse as a result of this social upheaval that stems from a complete demise of the agricultural production. Anyone who watches reality television is probably going to have to make some severe adjustments, or they'll go away, right? So there will be it's not fair to call it a cleansing, but there, I think we need to find aspects of it. A return, put it this way, there is while it's a requisite one, it is nonetheless a return to living in harmony with nature at a more basic level, in tune, as I call it, with your inputs and your outputs, and thinking of yourself as part of a living system. And also with a larger human community that I think has too often been lost in the West. You know, you don't know your neighbors anymore, most folks. So a rebirth of sorts, I think we can hold that, and we should hold that close as something that could be positive that flows from the upheaval that we're entering. But back to the grief and the denial, that first stage of grief, it's really important, I submit to you, to when you wake up each morning and you're booting back up and remembering these latest conclusions, it can be helpful to think about those conclusions and your convictions, and to sort of set an intention for the day to hold those and follow through on acting on them throughout the day, rather than, you know, I've got to go to work, which means I'll be surrounded by people who don't have any knowledge of the climate changes that are going on. And so I can just, so it's really easy for me just to be, in fact, I have to blend in with them. So I'll just sort of forget about what's going on. And then tomorrow will come and I won't be any more prepared. Yeah, I am challenging you to change that pattern. I'm not telling you to quit the job or to stop hiding, but come home ready to act on those convictions and start building the better future. I really feel for us all, everyone who's gaining this knowledge, reaching these conclusions. And I'll say it again, like I said last time, I really celebrate those of us who are able to integrate it into their life and make positive changes as a result. And that's what this show is all about. And I hope you can take that from it. These are hard conclusions that we're reaching, but they are supported by hard data. And as for continuing to appear sane to those around you, I will offer only you this quote from F. Scott Fitzgerald, who said, "The test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function." And that's what I mean. When you come home, you got to function. We got to move towards food security. Please start taking your food, your family's food security into your own hands. And with that, this has been episode 8 of the Ice Age Pharma podcast, mapping a path forward to prosperity through resilience, building self-sufficient communities, and sharing knowledge in the grand solar minimum. Let's go do awesome things.